Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Bo. We have a Twitter handle now for the podcast. It's Pardes Podcast. If you follow that, then you'll get a tweet every time we announce the publication of a new podcast. And that's Pardes Podcast using the Twitter system. We have Rabbi Daniel Landis, Rabbi Tzvi Hirschfield, and Yaffa Epstein, all Pardes faculty members. They will be touring the United States, giving talks in Berkeley, California, at Limud LA in San Francisco, California, Limud of the Bay Area, that's at Asilomar, San Francisco, Vancouver, and also in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So different talks in different places by different presenters, but any one of them would be great if you want to attend. The details I am publishing with this podcast, so just look at the podcast information on your iTunes, or you can go to podcast.pardesusa.org for all the details. This week, Bo by Neiman Novetsky. Neiman is a faculty member at Pardes. And now, Neiman Novetsky.
Thank you, Larry. Often, when we learn Tanakh, we get to stories which cause us to question the morality of its characters. How could Yaakov trick Yitzchak to get the brachot, to get the blessings that were meant for Esav? Was Avram correct to put Sarah in danger when he went down to Egypt? How could David adulter with Bathsheba and then kill Uriah, her husband? All these questions come up in almost every sefer that one learns in Tanakh. Sometimes, though, we question not just the biblical characters, not just our forefathers and foremothers, but the actions or the directives of God himself. In this week's Parsha and Parshat Bo, we'll see a case in point. The Parsha as a whole discusses the exodus from Egypt, and amongst the commands that God gives the people to do before they're about to leave is the following from chapter 11, verse 2. Daber na ba'aznei ha'am, v'yishalu ish me'et re'ehu, v'yisha me'et ru'uta, klei chesef u'chlei zahav. God tells Moshe to tell the people of Israel that they should go to their neighbors and they should ask of them and they should request of them silver vessels and gold vessels. The next chapter tells us them fulfilling this command. Ubnei Yisrael asu kidvar Moshe, and the people of Israel did as Moshe commanded. Vayishalu mimitzrayim klei chesef uchlei zahav usmalot, and they borrowed from the Egyptians gold and silver vessels and clothing. Vashem natan et chein ha'am b'nei Mitzrayim, and God allowed the people to find favor in the eyes of the Egyptians. Vayashilum b'netzlu et Mitzrayim, and they're able to go and borrow these things, thus perhaps taking advantage or perhaps saving them from Egypt. In these verses, Hashem tells Moshe that Bnei Yisrael should quote-unquote borrow gold and silver vessels from their Egyptian neighbors. The Egyptians were presumably under the impression that Bnei Yisrael were leaving for just a three-day vacation, as that, after all, is what Moshe has been asking Paro for all along, and that afterwards they would come back and these items would be returned. Bnei Yisrael, though, of course, were never planning on returning. So how could they lie, trick the Egyptians, and take all these valuables? In effect, isn't that stealing? Commentators throughout the ages have been bothered by these psukim. How is it that Hashem commanded us to, quote-unquote, steal from the Egyptians? A variety of answers have been given, and we're going to look at a selection of those. Let's start with the approach of Rav Sadia Gaon, who deals with our question by getting rid of it entirely. Rav Sadia Gaon writes, Chas v'shalom sheyatir HaKadosh Baruch Hu lignov da'at HaBriyot. He says, Chas v'shalom, it shouldn't even enter your minds that God would permit us to deceive other creatures. Sheyishalu mehem klei zechasev v'zahav v'lo yashivu lehem, that we should borrow and ask for these silver and gold items, not planning on returning them. Aval, lashon she'elahi shetitin la b'matana. He says, you've been reading the pasuk all wrong. Who said that they were borrowing from the Egyptians? The word she'elah doesn't mean borrow, but rather to ask that something should be given as a present. And he brings a proof text. Shekein matzinu bivat sheva, sheila achat ktana onochi shoelet mitach. So in the beginning of the book of Kings, Batsheva has a request, a sheila, that she makes of Shlomo, using the word sheila not to mean to borrow anything, but rather just to ask for something. Hare matanan nekret b'lashon sheila. And so he comes to the conclusion, a gift is worded in the wording and the language of a sheila, of a request. If we take Rav Sadia Gaon's approach, we have no question. Bnei Yisrael asked for a gift. The Egyptians agreed. They're never expecting anything back. No moral dilemmas, no problems. The problem, of course, is that not everyone agrees that the word sheila means a simple request. Shadal, for example, Shmuel David Lutzato, says, "Ein safek shezeh ma'aseh tachbula." Reading the same exact verses, he tells us, this for sure is a plot. Lashon sheila yaduahu shehu amenat tahachzir. The language of the word sheila is known that it means that you're asking for something that will be returned. In other words, you're asking to borrow something, not to be receiving it as a gift. He too brings a proof text. V'chi yish'al ish me'im re'ehu. If one borrows from his neighbor, v'nishbar omet, and it is either broken or it dies, balav enimo, and the owner is not there, shalem yishalem, he has to pay some amount. Shadal here is quoting psukim from the laws of watchmen. One of those watchmen is considered the person who borrows from his neighbor, and it has certain laws that he has to abide by. But there, the word ki yish'al ish me'im re'ehu is understood to be borrowing. So we seem to have a machloket, a disagreement between several commentators as to what does the word sha'al mean? How does Tanakh understand that word when it uses it? Interestingly, if one were to do a search of all the different places where the root Shin Aleph Lamed comes up in Tanakh, one would actually find that by far the majority of the cases uses it to mean a request. The understanding of the word borrowing in relationship to this root Shin Aleph Lamed comes up in only about four places in all of Tanakh. And if so, it makes you wonder, then why do so many commentators get bothered by our verse? If the simple reading of the word shall is to request, then why bother trying to read it to understand it as borrowing? It would be much simpler to just read it as request. So here it seems that we have a case where a more modern usage of a term is being brought back into people's understanding of Tanakh. And in this case, it might not even be a modern usage, but a usage that the people that we're talking about are used to. What do I mean? In halachic terminology, for people that are used to learning Bava Kamma and other Talmudic tractates in which the laws of watchmen are prevalent, the word sha'al always means borrow. And for many of the Rishonim, many of the people who are commentating on this verse, that might have been the area that they were more familiar with. Being Talmudic scholars, they might have spent a lot more time with the chapter in the Gemara that deals with the person who borrows than they are with the usage of the word sha'al in Tanakh as a whole. And for them, then, when they see the word sha'al, it automatically comes out glaringly to mean borrow, even though that might not be the real or main meaning in Tanakh itself. This is something that we do all the time, just to give another example. The word lehitchatein. Okay? In modern Hebrew, when we speak about somebody being mitchatein with somebody else, we say, it's so-and-so getting married to so-and-so, and we refer to the two parties who are mitchatein one in another, the two parties that are marrying as the husband and wife. Interestingly, in Tanakh, that's not the case. The word mitchatein in Tanakh is a coming together not of husband and wife, but rather of father-in-law and son-in-law. For example, when Shlomo gets married to the daughter of Paro, in Tanakh, it words that marriage as Vayitchatein Shlomo et Paro. And Shlomo, quote-unquote, married Paro, not the daughter of Paro. Here, too, is an example of a word that we're so used to. You ask anybody, what does the word Lehitchatein mean? And most people say, oh, marriage, husband and wife. But if you do a close reading in Tanakh, you realize that it's actually not used exactly the same way in Tanakh. And so coming back to us, again, perhaps the simplest way of understanding our verse is to say, no, the main usage of the word sha'al in Tanakh is request, and thus we get rid of our whole moral dilemma. The people requested things they never planned on giving them back. The Egyptians had no reason to expect that they would get anything back. Case closed. There's one more issue at hand, though. In our verse, the word sha'al doesn't come up just as a normal verb, but it also comes up in a certain form of the verb called the hifyel, vayash ilum. When something's in the hifyel form, it means to cause another to do something. And thus, the word vayash ilum in the pasuk really seems to have to do with lending and borrowing and not just requesting. And if so, that might be another factor that lead many to this moral dilemma that we have when reading our verses. If they were really just borrowing, then how do we understand the justice in their actions? So let's take a look at some of the different approaches. If one is going to take the assumption that they were borrowing, or perhaps even if they're requesting, just to understand that request further, why was it just? Why was it okay? So let's look at a passage from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which presents an agadic, a legendary type of story, which is trying to answer our question. The setting of the story is the time of the Greek dominion over Israel, and we have a group of Egyptians coming to court before Alexander. Pamachat ba'u b'nei Mitzrayim ladunim Yisrael lefnei Alexandrus Mogdon. Once there was a group of Egyptians who came to hold court and to ask a justice question against Israel before Alexander. Amrulo, harehu omer v'Hashem natan etchein ha'am b'nei Mitzrayim v'yashilum. They say, there's a verse in the Torah that says that God gave the people's grace into the eyes of the Egyptians, and they borrowed from them. Tnu lanu kesef v'zehav shenatata mimenu. And so now they say, we demand payment back of all those things that you took from us. Right, so 1,000 years later, the Egyptians are coming to claim back all of their possessions that they had lent to the Israelites. Amar Gavia ben Pasifsa l'chachamim. One man says to the chachamim, to the sages of the time, "Tnu li reshut ve'lech v'adunim." He says, "Let me go and deal with this." Im yinatzchuni, if they happen to win, Imrulahem hediot shebano nitzachtem. You don't have to worry about it. If I lose, you guys can always go and tell them, oh, that was just a simpleton who came to go and argue for us. Of course he lost your case. No one's going to hold it against you. I'm not considered one of the sages. V'im ani anatzeach, but if I do perhaps actually beat them, Imrulahem torat moshe rabbeinu nitzachtem. You could say, it's the Torah of Moshe which beat you out. Natnu lo reshut. So they give him permission. Amar lahem mechanaten mivien raya. He says to the Egyptians, well, what proof do you have for your case? Amru lo min haTorah. They say, from the Torah. Amar lahem afani lo avilachem raya ela min haTorah. So he says, you know what? I'll bring you proof from the Torah from my side as well. Shenemar, as it says, umoshav b'nei Yisrael asher yeshvu b'mitzrayim 30 shana v'arba me'ot shana. It says in the Torah, we lived in Egypt for 430 years. Tnu lanu schar avodah shel 60 ribo. He says, if your proof text from the Torah, my proof text from the Torah too, because that means you're accepting what's in the Torah. Well, it says in the Torah that we were enslaved for 430 years. So maybe you pay us back the worth of the work of the 600,000 people who were in Egypt for 430 years worth of work. Amar lahen Alexander Mogdon, hachziru lo tshuva. So Alexander Mogdon turns to the Egyptian and says, well, you have any reply? Amulo tnulanu zman shlosha yamim. They say, give us 3 days. Natan lahem zman. He gives them the time. Batku veloma tshuva. They had no answer. So the Gemara here, in a very amusing way, is presenting our dilemma, right? We borrowed something. You have to pay it back. The answer they give, of course, is we had every right to all of those things that we took out of Egypt because, after all, you enslaved us for 430 years without pay. We deserve something in return. Now, on one level, I think this Gemara is 100% accurate. Payment for the enslavement would have been worth way more than whatever vessels they happened to have borrowed. On the other hand, just because someone did you a wrong doesn't always allow you to do a wrong back. There could have been perhaps other ways where God could have made them pay us back for the work that we did without us tricking them into getting it. Nonetheless, The Gemara here is definitely presenting one type of an approach and trying to say there is justice in the act because we deserve payment for all that time that we were not paid for 430 years worth of enslavement. Other commentators go in a similar route, trying to see why it was that we actually deserved this money. The Chizkuni, for example, suggests, "B'makom she'enichu Yisrael batem ustotem uchlehem, shelo yachlu lasteti mehem, sh'arei hayu Yisrael nachalot b'mitzrayim k'dichti ve'yachazuba." He says, what were they taking this money for? Not for the years of slavery, but it was in exchange for all the things that they were leaving behind. B'nai Yisrael were about to go and leave Egypt, never to return. But when you leave, you can't pack everything. What were they leaving behind? Their houses, their fields, anything that they owned that they couldn't take with them was now going to be left behind in Egypt. And who presumably was going to go and take ownership over those things? The Egyptians themselves, of course. And if so, says Chizkuni, this is a fair exchange. We're leaving behind materials that are worth way more than what we're taking. This approach, of course, has a similar problem to the one that we just mentioned beforehand. Yes, it's fair on one level to exchange things, but one would think that you can go do so in a more upfront manner. One doesn't have to trick in order to go and do this type of a fair exchange. As a result, perhaps, Sforno decides to take this in a slightly different direction. And he says that, no, we weren't tricking, we earned the right to this, fair and square, with no injustice at all. What does he say? He says, granted, you're going to borrow all these different materials, and therefore you really are obligated to return them. But what happened? He says, but the Egyptians actually made this all just from the second that they started to run after Bnei Yisrael. Ki amnam, kasher metu bota milchama, haya bedin mida kenegin mida, kol shalal harodfim lanirdafim. He says, because what happens when Bnei Yisrael left Egypt and then the Egyptians decide to run after us, and then they all drown in Yam Suf? In effect, what was going on? The Egyptians had declared war on Bnei Yisrael. When they drown, we become the victors. And as we all know, to the victors belong the spoils. And thus, anything that used to belong to the Egyptians no longer has to be returned. So this read is a very innovative way, I think, of dealing with our problem, saying, look, we could have returned them. You, Egyptians, are the ones who made us not have any real reason that we have to. By running after us, you declared war, and thus, to the victor goes the spoils, all now belongs to us. And so we have a variety of ways of, quote-unquote, justifying our taking the vessels. We're still not sure, though, why God had to do so in such a tricky manner. If God had wanted to pay us back for years of slavery, one would think he could have come up with other ideas. We could have stumbled over some massive oil deposit in the desert. We could have gone and found, I don't know, gold someplace out there without having to do it from the Egyptians themselves. And so some say that really, God's ultimate purpose here was not to enrich Bnei Yisrael, but something else. Shaddai writes, actually, you know what, we'll take a step back. The Netziv tells us something else. He suggests, "Ritzono yitbarach haya shiyeh b'zeh ha'ofen shiyirdufu achar kach acharei Bnei Yisrael." Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin tells us, God's purpose was not to enrich Bnei Yisrael. Why did he have them take all of this stuff from the Egyptians? Because actually, he wanted the Egyptians to get upset. What does that mean? Any normal Egyptian, after seeing the Ten Makot, and seeing that Bnei Yisrael left, would say, good riddance, great, we're gone from them, they don't have to cause us any more problems. But God actually didn't want to end the story with the Makot. He wanted to end the story with the splitting of the sea and the drowning of the Egyptians inside. What was one way to ensure that the Egyptians would run after Bnei Yisrael if they had their stuff? People don't like it when someone has your stuff. And so the Egyptians decide to run after Bnei Israel, and in so doing, end up drowning in Yam Suf. Why was it so important for God to have our story end with a drowning in Yam Suf? Why couldn't we just have left Egypt and then we're free? So many suggest that this has to do with the slave mentality. A slave who's running away from his master, all the time that he knows his master is still alive, feels that he's a slave to that master. He's always going to be turning his back and his neck to go and see, are they running behind me? Having the Egyptians die in Yam Suf allows Bnei Israel to be totally free of their chains. There's no one that's going to be running after them anymore. And so God designed this whole story in order to get to that end point. Now going back to that Shaddai I had mentioned beforehand, Shaddai actually is bothered by a slightly different question. He says, how could God act with trickery? Won't that lead Bnei Israel themselves to act with trickery? Won't they learn that that's the way that we deal with people? That we're trickery, that we're trickers? He says, V'chilo haya yachol Hashem lashir et amo b'li sheyitzavei ma'asekva, what God couldn't figure out a way of enriching them without going over and doing this in this sly way? Omerani behefach. So he says, no, the exact opposite. Nirsham b'nafsham ki Hashem yashiv li'ish kif'alo v'yanish hara'im hamit'achzuri ma'ra'im. He says, no. The lesson that Bnei Israel learned was not that God tricks people. They learned a very different lesson. They learned that God punishes those that need to be punished and he rewards those that need to be rewarded. He sees the taking of these vessels from the Mitzrim, from the Egyptians, as a just punishment for all the things that they have done. And that Bnei Israel need to see a God who can go and reward those that need rewarding and punish those that need punishing. And that's the lesson that Bnei Israel would be coming out with from our story. I want to look at one last commentator, who reads our story slightly differently and takes it a step back to the time period of Makat Choshech. He points out that really what's going on in our story is that Bnei Israel are requesting, not borrowing, but requesting gifts. And he picks up on a funny word that Moshe uses in his command to Bnei Israel to do this. It says in the Pasuk, Daberna, please tell Bnei Israel that they should go and request gifts from the Egyptians. And he says, that's a very funny word to use. Normally, you don't have to tell someone, please do something, unless they're unwilling to do it. And why should Bnei Israel be unwilling to go and ask for gifts? Shouldn't they want those gifts? So he says, not always implies a certain reluctance, some opposition on the part of the person addressed. Why would Bnei Israel so resistant to this request? So he says, the people had just proved their sterling moral quality in the most brilliant manner. For 3 days long, their oppressors, chained in blindness, were completely helpless in their power. For 3 days long, all their treasures lay open in their houses, and no Jew took the opportunity to take the slightest advantage either against their persons or their possessions. He points out, before our command to go and take these vessels, had come Makat Choshech, the plague of darkness. For 3 days, the Egyptians were helpless in their houses. And he says, what happened during those 3 days? Bnei Israel proved the morality. They didn't harm them. They didn't take anything, right? Even though they'd been slaves for such a long time and presumably harbored quite a strong hatred toward their masters, they didn't take advantage of them at all during these 3 days. Interestingly, Rav Hirsch's reading stands in direct contradiction to some midrashim about the same Makat Choshech, where Bnei Israel actually did go into the houses of the Egyptians to search out what materials and possessions they own, so that afterwards they can ask for those specific things and say, what do you mean? I know you have it. It's in your third closet over there on top of the baggage, etc. And they could say, look, you have it. Give it to me. Apparently, the midrash was not bothered at all by our moral question. They certainly saw that there was justice in us getting whatever we deserved from the Egyptians and had no problem with Bnei Israel getting it however they wanted. Rav Hirsch, though, is reading our story very differently. He's saying, no. The Jews were moral throughout. During those 3 days of darkness, they didn't harm their bodies, they didn't harm their possessions, they didn't do anything. And in fact, That's what led the Egyptians afterwards to be so willing to give them things, because they too recognized the moral greatness of the Jews. He points out, this moral greatness on the part of his people, more than all the miracles God performed, made the man Moses great in the eyes of the Egyptians. And it must have indeed gone against the grain of Moses and the people to risk, to some extent, losing this moral victory by such requests. The reason Moshe had to say, please ask of them, is that actually Bnei Yisrael recognized that now they were finally seen in the eyes of the Egyptians as moral people, and they didn't want to lose any of that by going and asking, oh, can you give me something? And so Rav Hirsch reads our story as an example of the morality of Bnei Yisrael, not of the opposite. Part of what's going on here, of course, is the time period in which Rav Hirsch is living. Rav Hirsch is surrounded by non-Jews and is very, very aware of what perception Jews will have in the eyes of the non-Jews around them. And he wants to bend over backwards to make sure that we're seen as moral, decent human beings. And thus, in our story too, he's going to say, look, there was no hint of anything wrong going on here. During Makar Choshech, during the plague of darkness, we were the most respectful people. We didn't harm them. We didn't hurt them. We didn't take their possessions. And when God demands and commands us to go and ask for gifts, we don't even want to. Right? This isn't something that we want to do. God commanded us to do it, and he asked us to do it as a request. And because of the high moral character of Bnei Yisrael, the Egyptians are very willing to go and give whatever they request, not to lend, but to give. And so, we've seen quite a few different ways of addressing the question of this perhaps moral dilemma that is presented by God's command to quote-unquote borrow things, knowing full well that we're not going to return them, and have answered it quite simply by saying perhaps the whole basis of our question is wrong. The word sha'al does not mean to borrow, but rather to request. To others that see this as just payment for the entire time that we were slaves in Egypt, or perhaps for the things that we're leaving behind. To others who see an ulterior motive here, that the point wasn't to enrich Bnei Yisrael, but rather to either convince the Egyptians of a certain thing or to get them to go and run after us so that they can die in Yam Suf. To finally, Rav Hirsch, who's able to see in Bnei Yisrael's actions here, actually, an example of the morality of Bnei Yisrael. And with that, I wish you all a Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Neyma. And thank you for tuning in to the podcast. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.